House Committee on Revenue for April 12, 2017 will come to order. Colleagues, today we have three public hearings, and we're going to take them in the order they're printed on the agenda. So we'll start with the public hearing on House Bill 2384, and we open that. Kyle, you want to explain us what we're dealing with today?
Yes, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2384, it would establish a limit on the total amount of property taxes that are due for qualified senior homesteads, and it'd be equal, the limit would be equal to the amount of the property taxes due for the property from the previous year when the property owner applies for the program. It does abate the taxes that are in excess of that limit. So to qualify, it requires the individual to be 65 years of age or older at the time that they file the claim to have their property tax fixed. It does allow the property tax limit to be transferred to a new homestead once every 3 years. And it does require the claim to be filed with the county assessor, and then they forward that on to the Department of Revenue to determine eligibility for the program. And it does specify that the abatement or the fix of the property tax amount isn't in addition to and not in lieu of any other property tax exemptions, special assessments, or deferrals. It would begin with the 2018-19 property tax year. And I did include in the background an example to give some indication of the general concept of the bill and how it would work in the SMS. And using a base of, say, the 3% growth limit. So we have a limit of 3% of the maximum assessed value growth. So just using a standard 3% growth in taxes with a tax liability of, say, $3,000 on a homestead. If that homestead were to qualify, you can see in the SMS the example of the property tax savings for the individual, the homeowner. In year one, it'd be $90. Year two, $183. Year five, it'd be up to $478 because you're limiting or you're fixing the property tax at that point in time, and then you wouldn't have that 3% year-over-year growth in the property taxes for an unchanged property. So that's the general concept.
Thank you. Gentlemen, thank you for coming in to the Revenue Committee today. We're happy to have you.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you for hearing this bill. Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Smith-Warner, and Vice Chair Benson Committee. This bill I introduced a couple years ago, did not get a hearing, and reintroduced it this year and late in the session right now. I just thank you for hearing it. And this came about actually when I was first running for this position, and I was knocking doors over in Pendleton and came across an elderly lady in a small home. Oh, I'm sorry, Greg Barreto, House District 58. Thank you, Cliff. So anyway, I was knocking doors, and this elderly lady came to the door. She had an oxygen bottle and a small house and kind of an unkept yard. And she said, you know, all of my costs are going up, including my taxes on my home. She said, is there anything that you can do about this? My electricity is going up, food costs are going up, insurance is going up. And actually, she's not the only one who's in a situation like this. So House Bill 2384 came about to where if we could not reduce but just freeze the property taxes on people when they retire at 65 or older, that's really the gist of this bill. So it requires that an individual's primary source of income becomes fixed, establishes limit on a total amount of property taxes due for the qualified senior homesteads equal to the amount of property taxes due for the property tax year immediately preceding the first property tax in which the valid claim is filed. The bill circumvents the 3% annual growth in property tax liability for seniors on a fixed income, allows the limit to be transferred to a new homestead once every 3 years should they move. The limit only applies to the first 10 acres of land on which a homestead is situated and only to the portion of a multi-unit dwelling that the individual actually occupies. Requires the claim to be filed with the county assessor, which is then forwarded to the Department of Revenue for the eligibility determination. Specifies that the abatement is in addition to and not in lieu of any other property tax limit, partial exemption, special assessment, or deferral, and applies the beginning of 2018-2019 property tax year. So again, Mr. Chair, thank you for hearing this bill. I think there's a need out there to address some of these people in a situation of fixed income with prices going up in other areas, and I think it's something that we should address as a state. So,
thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sal Esquivel, Representative District 6. The reason I'm part of this is because I've always felt that we've never, in my opinion, done a lot to help people on a fixed income that are retired. And the worst thing I ever did was when I was a realtor about 22 years ago, I had to sell a fellow's house because he couldn't pay his taxes. Even though he wanted, I recommended that he defer them. He was in the era of the Great Depression when you didn't do things like that. So that individual, we ended up selling his house and ended up in an apartment. And I thought that was the worst thing we could have ever done. And of course, you know, Mr. Chair, that I've worked on ways to alleviate property taxes for people. And I think that it's something that we need to put some emphasis on and look at very closely because, you know, if you have Social Security, if you're living on that income, and you don't get a raise for 4 years, but your taxes go up 3% per year, doesn't take long to figure out you're losing on this gig. So I think we need to pay real close attention to our seniors on fixed income.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Hansel, a state senator for District 29, Northeast and North Central Oregon. House Bill 2384 sets a limit on the taxes that are due on homes where the occupant is a senior and is living on a fixed income. The bill states that only the 10 acres where the individual's homestead is located is exempted, or their portion of a multifamily dwelling. The bill is only for people ages 65 and older. The citizen must be living on a fixed income, and those individuals must apply to participate in the program. It isn't designed to be a blanket policy for everyone over 65. I would encourage your support on the bill. It is something that I think we can do for our seniors, of which I are one. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Representative Marsh, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here. I'm just wondering, Rep. Esquivel, you referred to the senior deferral program. I'm wondering, it sounds like these seniors, if they're on fixed incomes, would qualify for that program. Why wouldn't we sort of gently guide them into a full deferral rather than this approach?
Well, I think, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Warner and Bence, I think that we do try to do that as much as possible. Uh-huh. You know, you have some people that are still around from the Depression era. My mother's one of them. And unfortunately for her, that she's in a different situation now, but she would have been the same way. And you can defer those taxes, but what do you end up with when you pass on? Maybe they want to have something for their kids. I don't know. But I don't know what makes people tick like that, and I've tried to talk them into it before, and they've never gone for it. So I can't answer that, but maybe when I get to be a senior citizen, I can answer that, Representative.
Other questions for this panel? All right, Representative Johnson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate you guys being here. Is there a definition or an explanation in view of fixed income, what that entails? I mean, I think I know what your thoughts are, but is there any language you can think of that can refine it? Because I can think of some folks on certain retirement benefits that are fixed, but they're pretty generous, and I wouldn't think they're lacking for the ability to, address the issue that you bring up here.
Yeah, Chair Barnhart, Representative Johnson, this does not include Tier 1 retirees. Actually, this lady that I ran into was strictly on Social Security, mm-hmm. and I think there's a lot of people, and matter of fact, last year, 2 years ago, in business and labor, you know, they put together public program for private pensions, you know, for small business. And so there's a lot of people that are retiring without the income. There's a lot of people that have retired without any retirement that they put away for, and so they are just living on Social Security. So fixed income would be Social Security. Some people have a little bit more, some have a 401k, but pretty much fixed by the time they retire and are living in a world where inflation is a real thing.
Representative Smith? Did you have a question for this panel?
No, sir. I'm sorry.
I'm looking at that point that Representative Johnson raises. And I think it's line 17 and a couple more lines after that on page 1. The individual's primary sources of income are fixed income sources. Is there a definition in here somewhere of fixed income? I didn't see it.
I don't believe there is.
Let me tell you why I asked that question. We think of Social Security as being fixed, but it isn't. When there's inflation happening in the economy, Social Security goes up once a year. It hasn't happened lately, but that doesn't mean it won't. So depending upon what the definition of fixed is, it may be that having a Social Security income would not qualify you for this consideration. Yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm thinking that maybe we should probably try to do an amendment on this and cap it at $24,000 a year or $2,000 a month on Social Security or retirement, whichever one.
Well, I leave that to you to figure out what you might do. But that is, Representative Johnson raised it. I looked at it just now and thought,
that's a good
thought. This looks like might be a potential problem, might be a difficulty for the assessors to figure this one out without a definition.
So I think we could do that.
Yeah, can I speak to this too, Chair Barnhart? One of the things I guess I was looking at this as probably just a hearing. If we would have had the hearing earlier in the session, there would have been time maybe to define some terms and to do amendments. And so I don't mind bringing this bill back in the next session or in two sessions from now. With the idea that we refine it and correct some of the issues that come up as question marks. So,
okay, thank you. Anything else for this panel? Yeah, Representative Johnson.
I just want to make sure the representative knows that revenue stays open until sine die.
I wasn't going to remind you.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Johnson,
you may have a reprieve.
Thank you for your gracious reminder. We can do that this year.
my confusion is now cleared up. Thank you. I do appreciate that, Representative Johnson. Thank you. I appreciate your testimony. You can stick around or head back to committee. I know some of you have to have committees elsewhere in the building.
Holding up Ways and Means subcommittees.
I am
not
too,
there for
a quorum.
Ah, yes. Thank you. Gil Riddell, Douglas Schmidt, and Mark Garst. Take them in order, huh? Why not?
Hello. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's good to see you today. Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. AOC opposes this bill not because it isn't laudable, in fact it is, but it raises difficulties and questions that we need to present to you. There are administrative questions that Doug will respond to. The bill raises another question, one of intergovernmental relations. If this is sound statewide public policy, why does the bill use critical local property tax resources to pay for it? In fact, current Senate Bill 160 creates the template for the use of property tax exemption bills, a refundable income tax credit for a qualified senior homeowner with a property tax assessment greater than 10% of the homeowner's adjusted gross income. Income tax is Oregon's major revenue source, and this bill imposes state policy. Under Oregon's rate-based property tax system, it's already been cut, capped, and limited for the benefit of the property owner. And the property tax expenditure, it becomes a straight loss of revenue for essential local and state-shared public services. There is an existing program as a model, as you know, the senior property tax deferral. There's a quote that I'll finish with. It was a short-term recommendation from the Task Force on Comprehensive Revenue Restructuring, which reads, refrain from new property tax expenditures or state mandates on local governments. This recommendation is directed at the legislature and essentially says, do no harm that will make local governments' fiscal situation worse. And with a twinkle in my eye, I'm going to mention a couple of the voting members of that task force. Senator Rod Monroe, Representative Sal Esquivel, Senator Ginny Burdick, and your own good chair, Phil Barnhart. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Please.
And Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Douglas Schmidt, Polk County Assessor, I'm testifying on behalf of Osaka today, and we do oppose this bill. Again, not because of the need for this. We talk with seniors all the time in our offices. But because of the implementation issues, we are not even sure we can do these calculations. The taxes are frozen, and the above anything above that is abated, which means it's just gotten rid of. So we don't have any way to abate taxes currently. It appears we would almost have to do a double calculation because we have compression we have to account for. Then we would have to account for these reduced taxes. And each taxing district's rate that's calculated would have to be reduced somehow to get the correct calculation. The frozen taxes on a homestead, it's up to 10 acres. We don't break property out by 10 acres, so we would have to go through and either create a new tax lot for that, because it's calculating on a different mechanism than the remainder of the property. It would also maybe give an exemption on some income-producing property if it was on a farm. The bond, another issue I always like to bring up is the bond payments. The bond payments are calculated based on the total assessed value within the district. This doesn't address that. It's a reduction in the taxes. The assessed value would stay the same. So what that would do is eventually it would shift the districts would ask for more money in their bond payment because they know they're not going to get the full amount. Just like they do with the 3%, they ask for just a little bit more. So eventually this would pass that abatement onto for the bonds off onto the other taxpayers in that district. Representative Esquivel mentioned a taxpayer that he had talked to about who didn't want to go under the deferral program, and I have had many conversations with seniors in that of that generation that don't want to have a burden to their children. And when I asked them if their children would be moving into the home when they passed away, they said no, they would probably just sell the home. And so I have further conversation as to why not go under the deferral program and be able to live in your home comfortably, and your children would just get $5,000 or $10,000 less out of the sale of your property. So there is an issue of some seniors not wanting to go under the deferral program, but there is a mechanism out there that would fit this category of low income or fixed income, if it means Social Security, seniors. So we would ask that this bill not, in its current form, not be moved forward, and maybe instead look at some mechanism of incorporating these people into the existing senior deferral program.
Yes, sir.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Mark Garst with the Oregon Department of Revenue Property Tax Division. The department's neutral on the policy of giving some relief to seniors for property taxes. We do have some administrative concerns about the bill. The bill indicates that the property can be owned or co-owned by the senior, and so you could have a senior with a very small interest in a piece of property who would still qualify for the tax freeze, and then we would end up subsidizing folks who were not seniors their property taxes. So we consider that to be a bit of an issue. It indicates that the limit may be transferred to a new homestead once every 3 years. If somebody moved from a county that had a very low median value to a more expensive county, or if they just moved within the county from a very inexpensive home to a much more expensive home, you could get some really weird results where folks were paying a very low burden as far as their share of, you know, services in that community. We think that you could deal with this slightly by looking to the senior deferral program. We've created some new allowances for folks folks to downsize. And so if you did want to have this be transferable, maybe you have to move into a home that's less valuable than the home you're currently in would be one solution. We have a concern about the primary source of income being fixed income. First of all, we wonder what primary means. And secondly, we really don't think that fixed income means any certain dollar amount. And so, you know, my parents are both on pensions. They are quite comfortable, but they definitely consider themselves to be on a fixed income, as they tell me every time we go out for dinner. it looks like we have a requirement for annual filing in this bill. And the Department of Revenue's research folks have done some very rough, back-of-the-napkin demographic type analysis, and we feel like it could be as many as 300,000 folks who could qualify for this program. And processing that number of annual returns, applications, that would be quite the burden on the department and could become quite expensive. Maybe we could lighten this burden a little bit by having it be through a sworn statement by the taxpayers that this is their homestead. Maybe we could require that this be their voter registration or their driver's license registration, something along those lines, to try and give us a step towards figuring out what the homestead is. But in many ways, with this number of people, it's almost certainly going to be a lot of there's going to be a lot of trust involved in the program. I think I'll put it that way. And then the last thing that I would say is that the applicability date is for next year's tax year, and I think that it would really take a little bit longer to get a program like this up and running. And that's all I had.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? I have one, and I'm not sure who it's for. Either of the two on the ends, I think. Does this bill appear to cover anybody who is not covered by the senior deferral program as we see it now, especially if we were to add Representative Barreto's $24,000 income limit in this bill?
I'll take that one. Yeah. Sure. Chair Barnhart, yeah, absolutely it would. There are a number of...
They're 100% overlap, isn't it? Well, everybody who qualifies under this bill also would qualify for the senior deferral, wouldn't
they?
No,
not true. Because, Chair Barnhart, there are total asset restrictions in the senior deferral program that don't apply to this. There are restrictions on the value of the home.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Requirements not to have a reverse mortgage. There are requirements to carry insurance. There's the property can't be in a trust to be in the deferral program. And you have to have been in your home for 5 years to be in the deferral program. So there are, and the deferral program has a different income requirement as well. So there would not perfect overlap.
Thank you for the reminder. Yeah. We worked really hard on those sideboards. It's amazing how quickly one can forget. That's me, not you. Thank you. Any other questions for this panel? Thank you, gentlemen, very much. Appreciate it. Marcia Kelly and Wendy Johnson, please.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. As my colleagues before, same position, we oppose the bill, not because we don't think it's a great policy idea of being able to help out seniors, but the sideboards just aren't there. And I want to start with the big premise again, because that's my job of property taxes, a city, county, main revenue source. And it's to pay for services. It's to pay for water, it's to pay for sewers, to pay for the police. And each time the legislature provides another exemption, you're taking away from that pie. And we're, you know, the good representative started off with, well, seniors are on a fixed income and their costs keep going up. Well, cities, counties, school districts are on a fixed budget because we are stuck with Measure 5 and 50 and our costs keep going up. So we're in that same situation. And so for those reasons, we have to oppose. Measure 50 says we can only go up 3% a year, and there's been a lot of criticism of that because we don't go up 3% when the housing is going down, and yet our costs are going up more than 3%, and this bill would just wipe out that 3% altogether. And so that's a problem. The senior property tax deferral program obviously is one of the solutions to this situation, and we think that is an adequate program. This bill would have significant costs to Department of Revenue because it would require them to administer. And so I would hate to see the fiscal analysis for that because they have to get all the applications and approve them all. And as you've already heard just this week on the county assessor's bill, that CAFA program that funds DOR and what the assessors have to do, we don't have enough money in that program already. So adding another task is just too much at this point. I just looked at the census data in Oregon, the 2015 census, 16% of the population is older than 65. And there is no income limit on it as the bill is written. So that was the number I was looking at of 16% of 4 million. Wow, that's a lot of people that would be potentially eligible. Now, if you obviously put a $24,000 income level on it, I don't know what the numbers look like for how many people, but it's the revenue impact. We would definitely need to know what that looks like, but it's scary at first blush. Anything else? I think those are the highlights. Obviously, our PERS costs are going up. Our other costs are going up, too. And so for those reasons, we would oppose. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Barnhart and members of the committee, my name is Marcia Kelly, and I'm the public policy advocate for the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition. And we, too, think that while it's laudable to worry about seniors in their home, we are against the bill. There is no income limitation. The senior deferral program has a household income limitation of $43,000. So if there was something put in as a limitation, I would think that that would be something else. But we're basically against the bill because of what it does to local services. Many of those services seniors need to take advantage of. And one of the things that I'm intimately aware of is the need for public transportation in all areas of the state. There are special districts and transportation districts or counties who fund that. And so if you start freezing the tax for a goodly number of people, it is going to have implications. According to the Oregon Employment Department, who crunched numbers in November of 2016 from the U.S. Census, several of the more rural counties have older populations. In southern Oregon, both Douglas and Josephine counties have populations where one out of four residents are over 65. So we've been hearing about these distressed counties for most of the session, and you're talking about then capping property taxes in these counties that really need the services. It makes no sense. The senior deferral program is there. It has sideboards. It has limitations, but they're fairly generous. The $43,000 household total income is good. Their last year's net worth assets, real property, cash, savings accounts, bonds, and other investments after deducting outstanding liabilities and excluding the property on which the property tax deferral is sought, if it's over $500,000, they don't qualify for the deferral program. But assets being assets, remember that for many of these people, they consider their home one of their main assets, and that is outside of this asset limitation. There are pretty good sideboards on the property tax deferral. Since it's in existence, we don't see that there's a need for this additional help, and it does nothing to help many of the seniors who are not living in their own homes but are renting. So,
thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Thank you. Oh, Representative Vance.
Mr. Chair, excuse me. Actually, this probably was for the prior panel, but perhaps this panel can answer the question. The assertion is that we don't have any challenge when it comes to this demographic, and one measure would be how many foreclosures, tax foreclosures, we actually have each year. That would give us kind of the temperature of how dramatic this problem is. Perhaps one of the people who was up here last can tell us if there's been a dramatic increase in county assessors throwing people out of their homes, or if it's sorry.
We know where you live.
Not very often.
Very well.
Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Bentz, I came up here for this abuse to tell you I don't know that number, but I can try and find out for you through our, at least in Polk County, and maybe through the Treasurers Association of Oregon, and see if they have any idea of seniors that have been foreclosed for tax purposes. I know we have, I will say that we have very few, Doug Schmidt, Polk County Assessor, we have very few tax foreclosures, very few. Mostly it's the mortgages, things like that. So there's very few actual property tax foreclosures on residences. But I can try and find out that number.
Please. Yeah.
Right. A more telling number would be the years, how close you get to the actual, because of course the lender is going to pull the trigger on the foreclosure before you guys do. Mm-hmm. 100 times out of 100 almost. If there is a lender.
Mm-hmm.
So, but there must be some way of measuring that, and that's what I'd be most interested in, to see if there's been an upward trend in folks facing those kinds of challenges. You could look at the number of situations where you're 4 years back, and then I've gone through the process. It goes much longer than that, but
mm-hmm.
yeah, if we could get some number that it would and see what the trend is, that would be helpful in this discussion.
Representative Barnhart, Chair Bentz, are you asking for numbers that deal with even mortgage foreclosures and seniors, or just the tax foreclosure?
Well, it's not the tax, excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Property tax foreclosure.
What I'm asking is, in the normal course of events, the lender will find out about this, and then that will trigger a bank foreclosure. I'm more interested in knowing how many people are close to that particular point, because usually the bank will wait and see how far behind you are, and then they'll step in and protect their position because they're behind you. The way to do this, we could look at some of the numbers we looked at over the past couple of weeks, because the interest rate on those delayed taxes is it still 16%? It's still 16%. So we could look at how many people are paying 16% right now, and that'd give us an idea. See if that trend is up, because that would give us the number of people that are delinquent and not yet have been foreclosed upon.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Bentz, I will try and find out if there's any way to determine those numbers and get back to you. It may take me a week or so to get information from the treasurers.
I don't want you to do a whole bunch of work. Mm-hmm. If there's some simple way of telling us if there's an increase in the number of people finding themselves facing that kind of situation, and I don't know how we'd ever do the demographic piece, but just to know whether we're, but usually this would not be happening in an up economic situation. But I'm just right. Trying to get some sense of place here, given the nature of the bill that's before us.
And Chair Barnhart, Representative Bentz, there is a program out there. I'm not that familiar with it, but if a person is delinquent in their property taxes, there is an organization or a program out there where if they can show that they have the ability to make the payments once they're caught up, then they can get a grant from this organization to pay those taxes. So there's that possibility out there too. But to your question, I will try and find out for you if there's an upswing in this, and if we can quantify it, I can try and get that to you.
Thank you.
My recollection is that when if there are delinquent taxes, when a person joins the deferral program, those taxes are held in abeyance until the time that the deferral program ends. Is my recollection correct?
Chair Barnhart, that is correct. If they are delinquent 1 or 2 years and they qualify for the senior program, then those taxes are left on the account and not pursued until they come out from underneath the deferral program. I can verify that with you. I'm not the tax collector. But I can verify that and make sure that is correct.
Thank you.
And Chair Barnhart, I meant to say one thing. In looking at the senior deferral program, there's a booklet that you read through and fill out on the DOR website. But the Josephine County Assessor's Office has sort of a little checklist for people that I found pretty thorough, and they say this doesn't say that you'd qualify, but here are the things that you need to worry about, and it's pretty much a checklist right down, which in my age where I would qualify for a senior deferral if we didn't have income that was not fixed, I found it fairly easy to understand.
Great. Thank you very much. Any other questions? Thank you. We appreciate your testimony. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2384 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3260. Is that yours, too?
No.
No? Oh, Mass.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, House Bill 3260 deals with the issues of transient lodging tax. However, it deals with the issue of allowing the county going up to 5% or levying up to 5% on local taxes after they go to electors. And this comes primarily as tries to relax from the 2003 House Bill 2267 when the transient lodging tax was established. It put a moratorium on the ability of local governments to levy their own taxes, except the exception is that 70% of that work would go to, or 70% of the taxes would go for purposes of promoting tourism. Now, this bill tries to use that up to 5% of the tax defined for coastal counties, and the 5% specified to be on vacation homes, and use that for the primarily solving issues of housing and development and so on. So that is what most of the bill does. You have a section at the end, section 3, and this section 3 is not necessarily anything new. It's a rewrite of the section, subsection 7 from the top from line 24 and making it into its own. This is to be consistent with the statutes that are for the state transient lodging tax, so making those for the local government more consistent with the state amount. So this is nothing new. It's just the rewrite and the restructuring of that.
So is that basically a Scrivener's fix from LC? Is that
yes.
What you think it is?
Yes.
Okay. All right. And let me make sure I understand. The bill looks like it allows an additional a local transient lodging tax of up to 5%. Would that be in addition to the taxes that are already allowed?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Thank you. Other questions for Mazin? Gil Riddell, Bill Hall, Bill, I'm going to make this.
Barkline.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'm presenting you a double bill today.
Yes.
For the record, Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. To my right is the current AOC President, Lincoln County Commissioner Bill Hall. To my left, Bill Bartline from Tillamook County. We're here to strongly support this bill. I'd like to begin with a brief history of the local transit lodging tax for context, and then explain why this bill is needed, and then turn to comments of the bills who can tell you on the ground situations that they're facing. 15 counties have local transit lodging taxes. Until 2003, this was an entirely a local tax managed by locally elected officials. Local communities had been perfectly able to shape and approve the TLT that best fit local circumstances after agreements with businesses and others. All county TLTs used at least a share of the proceeds for economic development and tourism. In 2003, there was a bill that imposed a new 1% state transit lodging tax, continuously appropriated to the Oregon Tourism Commission, but the bill didn't stop there. It imposed requirements and limitations on local transit lodging taxes under rigid definitions, directing specific purposes of the local tax for the benefit of a particular industry.
In spite of the effort of supporters of the bill to seize 100% of any increased or additional new local transit lodging taxes for their own purposes, cities and counties were able to retain traditional local control over a mere 30%. The result was, after July 1st, 2003, a county may increase its existing TLT or adopt a new one only under limitations which I have listed in the testimony. House Bill 3260 addresses the growing imbalance created since 2003 of increasing major investment in the promotion of the tourist industry, single industry. For our calendar year 2015, nearly $18 million statewide, versus communities' ability to have means to manage the impacts of the industry. According to the Transit Lodging Tax Work Group report, at page 6, quoting, although the industry generates a large number of jobs that are geographically dispersed around the state, the wages are relatively low in that industry. If you look at the means at hand of some of the communities to provide public services needed as a result of the industry, the imbalance is apparent. I cite Lincoln City as an example. Total property annual property tax revenue, including bonds, at $7.3 million to fund all of their essential local public services versus a relatively enormous $5 million restricted revenue for lodging taxes. To put this imbalance in real-life terms, particularly with respect to the housing appropriate to these low-paid employees of the industry, I have two commissioners with me who will address that in a moment. This bill would permit voters of coastal counties to impose a local TLT on residential short-term vacation rental property of up to 5% of the consideration rendered strictly for the purpose of affordable housing within the county's coastal communities. Affordable housing, the type needed by employees in this industry. AOC asked the tourism industry and its supporters to relax their rigid stance and acknowledge that they have a very real role to play in the grander picture of tourism as an industry and the communities it affects. This bill is a positive tool to round out the overall benefits provided by that industry. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Gentlemen, thank you for traveling all the way to Salem.
It's a pleasure. Chair Barnhart, Vice Chairs Benson, Smith, Warner, and committee members, as you already heard, my name is Bill Hall. I'm in my fourth term as a Lincoln County Commissioner and AOC President for 2017. I'm also here to ask for your support for HB 3260. I know you're all aware that our state is experiencing a housing shortage virtually everywhere, but the coast is one of the places where it is particularly acute. In addition to the problems that exist in most places, such as financing and developer capacity, the coast is a place where average wages and average housing prices, both for rentals and home ownership, are particularly out of whack. Many of our jobs are part-time and seasonal, and the majority of those are in the tourism industry. In Lincoln County, for example, the average person earning minimum wage is 31 years old. When I took office in 2005, people were distressed that we had 400 students in our countywide school district who met the federal definition of homelessness. Well, this last school year, we just fell 30 short of 1,000 homeless students. Now, to express that another way, that's more than 14% of the total school-age population in the county versus a statewide average of just over 4%. Meanwhile, we've got a rental vacancy rate in the county of less than 1%, and only a minority of housing stock that's full-time owner-occupied. So the law of supply and demand comes into play here. Again, since we're using Lincoln City as an example, 40% of the private homes are primary residences, 30% are in the vacation rental pool, the remaining 30% are part-time residences, not in the rental pool. No wonder I get calls all the time from coffee stand owners, restaurant managers, health clinic managers, and countless other business people telling me that housing prices and housing availability are their number one barrier to employee recruitment and retention. Because there's still been demand for high-end homes and homes to be built specifically as vacation rentals, we have seen very little development aimed at working families. One exemption was a developer who did build 87 apartments in Lincoln City recently. He told me that when he advertised the availability of those last 30 units, he received 400 applications. So clearly, the need is there, the demand is there, and 3260 provides one more tool that coastal communities can use to meet that need. I want to close with a very brief history of Lincoln County's TLT. It was first adopted in the mid-1970s. Since then, our commissioners have been cautious in asking the voters to increase it. That has only been done 3 times since the original measure was adopted. I think coastal communities watch the industry and watch each other carefully and have and will exercise reasonable constraint in asking the voters to increase it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Chair Barnhart, Vice Chairs Bentz and Smith Warner, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Bartline. I'm currently serving in my second term as a Tillamook County Commissioner. I'm here today to also ask your support of HB 3260. Shortly after taking office as a Tillamook County Commissioner, I decided to conduct a wellness check on our community and formed a small committee to look at community vitality. We quickly discovered that the lack of affordable housing was a huge issue. We found out from our local employers were experiencing great difficulty recruiting employees due to lack of affordable housing and housing available for their managers, teachers, nurses, even transitional housing for our doctors. My spouse and I are both certified public accountants, and since I'm no longer working in the tax practice, she keeps me updated on the status of the landlord clients I used to have. It is now not uncommon to receive over 40 or more applications within a very short period of time when a house becomes available for rent, and usually these houses don't stay on the market for more than 30 days. After being made aware of the ongoing housing problem, the county set up a housing task force committee. Within weeks of establishing this committee, received over $60,000 in contributions from the business community who saw the need in our community. We received an additional $40,000 Meyer grant, which enabled us to conduct a housing needs assessment. We recruited a consultant company with nationwide experience to conduct this assessment, and its results provided some very sobering facts about the housing situation in Tillamook County. Now, we have provided this electronically for you, the housing assessment. Some of those facts include that from 2000 to 2014, our housing inventory increased by 2,513 units, while at the same time, our second homes and vacation homes increased by 2,623 units. This resulted in a net loss of 110 housing units for our employees and working families. We have over 1,100 short-term vacation rentals in the county. Almost all of them are owned from outside of Tillamook County. These vacation rentals generate approximately $26 million in gross rents. Of that, $24 million leaves our county to other areas. Our consultants noted that for generations, Tillamook County was one of America's best-kept secrets. However, today, this is no longer true. The tourism industry has grown enormously at the coast, especially here in Tillamook, and it is placing a heavy strain on all of our community resources, from policing to fire to search and rescue, but especially on housing. Tourism has created a much-needed jobs in our county. However, these jobs are mostly low-wage, seasonal, and poverty-level. The assessment study showed there are 2,266 residents working in the retail and food service industry in the county, and they are earning an average wage of approximately $20,000 a year. With this level of income, you can only afford to pay $500 per month in rent, or your in dire straits. In Tillamook County, there are only 239 units within this low rental price range, which means a substantial number of our workers in the tourism industry are rent impaired and are struggling to pay for basic necessities such as food, utilities, and transportation. Our consultants determined that we need at least $10 million invested over the next 10 years to get ourselves out of the housing crisis, but further noted there are very few local funds available to keep Tillamook County to even start the process. One of the consultants' recommendations to us was to ask the state legislature to enable coastal counties to approach their voters and ask for approval for a transit lodging tax on short-term rentals, which would fund the low-income housing not only for the tourism economy, but for all the low-income housing in Tillamook. Finally, as a CPA, I can tell you that asking for a new tax is a heavy lift for me. But also, as a CPA, I see the cause and effect of vacation rentals that are placing our long-term rentals and creating a very challenging housing shortage in our community. The tourism industry, as it continues to grow, is creating an increased need for low-wage employees who in turn need affordable housing. The tourism industry is a large contributing factor to the housing crisis facing Tillamook County today. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. These guys are the experts. Questions for this panel? Representative Smith, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not necessarily a question, but a statement. My wife's mother lives in Lincoln City, and all I can say is you folks are hitting this message right on the head. Our family's been able to see firsthand what you folks are discussing today. So I think the committee should really heed what's being told to us.
Thank you. Representative Vance, please.
Thank you. How much would this raise if it was fully implemented?
If it was fully implemented in Tillamook County, it would raise about $1.2 million a year, which over 10 years would get us out of the situation we're in. So, you know, a sunset on the bill after 10 years would be fine. But we need something now and immediate to get it off the ground and start doing something in our community.
Please.
Right. What would that something be?
If we could get, you know, in Tillamook County, we're kind of isolated. We're a poverty county. Our taxes are really low. We don't have any boots on the ground that can go after the state grants for housing, such as the mental health grants, the $40 million the legislature put out, or any other the state programs, because we don't have boots on the ground doing this. We are a member of Northwest Oregon Housing Authority. They're our housing authority, but they're situated in Clatsop County. They have nobody in Tillamook to do the recruitment and the work on that. To get the tax credit housing, you need at least $300,000 just to put together the application, and we don't have $300,000 to put together an application in Tillamook County. What I would really like to see is us either establish our own housing authority within our community or a community development corporation that could focus on our housing needs for our low-income folks.
And I really hate to ask this question, but I'm going to anyway. Is the when it comes to mobile home parks and that type of housing, which I think most of us would hope we could do better, but maybe that's where we are. Has there been a dramatic expansion of those types of housing locations in and along the coast? Is that something we're trying to avoid? I don't even know where it fits in the great scheme of discussion, but I'm just curious.
In Tillamook County, we do have some mobile home parks, but we're also losing them because the value of the land is far more to put in housing than it is for the mobile home park. So even there, we're getting some squeeze.
Yeah, I have not seen any new mobile home parks in Lincoln in some time. I think, to be honest, the affordable housing community is somewhat split on mobile homes. Some people are not fans of them, others are. I think, you know, I have had talks with some folks. If financing was available, they've talked about developing as either a cooperative or a nonprofit, a manufactured home park, with the modern homes, which are better construction, more energy efficient, and if it was owned by a nonprofit, then you could just generate enough revenue to maintain it without needing to generate a profit. So I think that this is the kind of thing that this potentially could open up.
Thank you.
Other questions? This proposal in some ways is self-limiting, isn't it? Mm-hmm. If you tried to levy the whole 5%, and that had a negative effect on the tourism industry, you'd have to pull back, wouldn't you?
You would.
Mm-hmm. What's your assessment of that question now? Is there room for this much additional price on transient lodging?
In our county, I believe there is. We're running out of homes for vacation rentals. It appears that when we implemented a 10% tax 2 years ago, the sky was falling. We heard from all of the business owners, but in reality, they've had almost $1 million a year for advertising, $500,000 to $1 million. Our tourist industry has just exploded, so it really has not negatively impacted the motel rentals or the short term rentals. They're continuing to expand and they're continuing to make money.
In Lincoln County, you know, if this does become a reality and an option for us, I think one of the things we'd have to take into account is, unfortunately, not knowing this was on the horizon, just last year we did put out an increase in our county tax from 9% to 10%, and that was approved by the voters, and we heard some sky is falling kind of rhetoric, you know, emails from folks saying that many of us will have to sell our properties if this becomes a reality, but I did not see any kind of drop in visitor traffic last summer or uptick in properties for sale. So, you know, I think I did an informal study before we put that last proposal out, and if you go up and down the coast, I think, you know, the 10% local tax is probably the most common. You'll see some, I think, maybe as low as 8%. I think the highest is 12%. So, yeah, in a sense, it is self-limiting because I think any county that's responsible at all, like, you know, Tillamook, I wouldn't expect to go to 15% if Lincoln is still sitting at 10, but mm-hmm. a percentage or two.
Now, Washington and California both have sales taxes.
Mm-hmm.
And they also charge transient lodging taxes.
Very true.
I'm assuming that those transient lodging taxes are in the range of what you're charging, and then they add the sales tax on top of that. Is that accurate?
I believe that's accurate.
Okay. All right. Representative Benz?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. There's a fairness issue, of course, and why these folks as opposed to somebody else, but I'm just curious what your alternatives are. Is this it?
Good question.
We do have the option of a 1% construction tax on new construction. Senate Bill 1533, mm-hmm. It's a brand new bill. We are actively looking at imposing that. It would provide, we think, somewhere between $200,000 and $300,000 per year for housing. There are some pretty severe limitations on how that can be spent, but it would provide maybe up to 30% of what we need. And so you could blend the two. If you went 2% of the transient lodging tax with that, would get us into a pretty good position for moving forward.
Yeah.
One last question. And I don't know where your cities are when it comes to city-wide sales taxes. Is that not a happy thought, or you've already been there, done that, can't do it? I mean, what is it that – why is this – particular source any more attractive than what I just mentioned or less?
Hmm. I don't know of any communities on the coast with a citywide sales tax. I mean, I know of a couple with local gas taxes, at least one with a food and beverage tax, Ashland. Also, Yahats has one. But those, I don't think they get us to where we'd need to be.
No, I don't think so. And I think it would be a heavy lift for the cities to impose that. And quite frankly, even though I probably shouldn't say this, it's a lot easier to tax somebody visiting your county than taking it out of your own pocket. And we all pay that when we go to Sun River. I think theirs is 26%, and that's a beautiful place to go to. And they spend their money to make your stay pleasant, and it seems like their employees are happy. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Marsh.
And speaking of Sun River and other places that do not touch the Pacific Ocean, is there any particular reason why a proposal like this should be limited to those counties that touch the Pacific Ocean?
Not necessarily, in my book.
Not necessarily, but it seems to be hitting the coastal communities really hard. I mean, this tax.
I suspect Bend would have a similar story to tell, Ashland to some degree.
Well, if Ashland and Bend come forward, we might have a conversation about that, perhaps. Other questions for this panel? Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate
thank
it
you,
very
thank
much.
You, Chair.
Mr. Van Leiningham, you didn't sign up, but did you want to be heard today?
No.
Thank you. Mr. Perry, Ruth Atkins, and Ms. Weiser, please.
Thank you, Chair Barhart. Members of the committee, for the record, Bill Perry at the Oregon Restaurant Lodging Association. Obviously, you could probably guess we're opposed to this. And a couple of different reasons. As most of you have heard these conversations before, the frustrating thing from our position is I understand the local governments are in a tight situation. Obviously, the previous bills we talked about, 5 and 50, have demolished their revenue source. But every time a issue comes up, in this particular issue, it's housing, they want to use the lodging taxes. I think most of you have heard in your different areas, they want to use lodging taxes for police. They want to use lodging taxes for beautification. They want to use lodging taxes for roads. It's everybody always comes back to lodging taxes. That's why we worked with the 2003 legislature, because, you know, you can't be coming back to the same industry time and time again every time there's a problem. And I know everybody can make the nexus. I understand that. But generally, if you have a high tourism industry in your area, there's a high percentage of those businesses that are paying property taxes. When people travel to your area, they're paying gas taxes. So these tourists, facilities, or everything else are contributing to the community in the ways that they're done. So, you know, we just keep wanting to go back to them every time there's an issue in one of these communities to come back for lodging taxes. And that's why we looked for 2003 to say, you know, you can't come back to the same source. We need to fix the overall funding problem. This is not a Band-Aid. You know, we need to fix what's happening in the local governments, and we're here to help. Obviously, we're less likely to help when we keep becoming the target every time somebody can say that there's a need in their community. Second, short-term rentals are a problem. They are, you know, in a lot of ways, they're not regulated like a hotel are for safety. They're not paying their taxes in many cases, as we've heard in different pieces of legislation. And we as an industry have always come forward and say we need to find a way to get enforcement of the taxes so they are paying. But they are an important part of this industry. Anybody that has a family sometimes would rather stay in a short-term rental than a hotel, especially when your children go to bed at different times, as our family does. And so there is a need to make sure that this is part of the industry, but they usually don't fall under land use codes. They're usually not paying their fair share of taxes in many ways, and they're not regulated for safety. And so I do think there's a way we need to address them under different scenarios to make sure that they're included the same way that other lodging properties are. But I don't necessarily think this deals with that. And the chair's question about the fairness, I mean, or the affecting the way that people travel. And, you know, to say that, answer that question in a blanket statement is just too difficult, because somebody that's going to stay in downtown Portland and pay $300 for a room is not going to care about the lodging tax. But, you know, another way to look at it, if you go on I-5 and you see Motel 6, Super 8 motels, those are bargain shoppers. And so if you have a different rate in a different community, they're going to know it, and it's going to affect the outcome. So, I mean, to say that it's not going to affect the industry, it really depends on how you look at that industry and how it's going to attract it. And two, the other thing you do by this bill is you're creating a different tax for a specific lodging property in an area. So they can stay at a hotel and pay 5% less, or at a lodging property or a house and pay 5% more. There's an inequity there that, once again, in your lower priced properties, I would say will have an impact. In your higher priced properties, I think it's harder to argue. And then lastly, I just want to say we are really about trying to make sure that everybody gets treated fair equally in this industry, whether it comes to regulation or taxes or anything else. And so when you're taxing one segment of the industry over another, it just really makes it harder. What we want to try to do is make sure the current tax system is enforced fairly and equally. And I think once we get to that point, it's easier to have some of these different conversations. But the previous panel talked about low wages in this industry on the coast. And I'm not going to sit up here and argue that, but as one of my members once said when they were testifying in front of a different committee, said, we go through a recession every year. It's called winter. And so if you're trying to keep a business open on the coast, you have about 3 months of profitable business. And you have 9 months of unprofitable business. And once again, all the industries that they mentioned there, retail, restaurants, and everything else, they're not getting taxed under this measure. And so what you're trying to do is make up for an inequity in a different segment of the industry with a tax on one segment of the industry. And so there's a local tax issue problem. I will say, as an industry, we tried to help Tillamook County a while ago under the previous chair to try to get a bond towards their roads. I think anything that is a broad-based tax, we will be helpful in, because I know there are issues. But we need to stop trying to target specific industries to shoulder the burden every time there's an issue in these communities. And we're here to help if it's a broader-based tax. If it's a sales tax, we're here. I've testified in this committee for a sales tax. But if you're trying to get at the tourism industry, a sales tax is better, because only about 23% of the dollar spent by a tourist is spent in a hotel. Mm-hmm. And so there are different ways to get at this issue, but we need to stop trying to target small segments of the issue to face the bigger problem. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much.
Jody Weiser speaking for Tax Fairness Oregon, and I'm sorry for those of you who heard virtually the same thing this morning. But I will say that I agree with Bill that I would imagine they left the hotels out because they were hoping you wouldn't come up and speak against the bill. And in all fairness, both segments of the housing at the beaches should bear the same tax rate. But as a state with no sales tax and low lodging taxes, Oregon is missing out on revenue that we should be collecting, both from vacation and business visitors. And nearly every tourist community has this problem, not just the beach ones and not just Tillamook itself. Our statewide lodging taxes are amongst the lowest in the nation, and most local jurisdictions are not collecting significant lodging taxes, partly because of the 2003 law and the prohibitions on how money would be spent that you've heard about. So we looked across the country to look at how we compared, and found 11 cities that are collecting at 17% and not lodging taxes. We didn't have an Oregon city close to that range. In fact, ours range from 2 to 12.5%. So there's a lot of difference there. I first came to this issue when I stayed in Chicago and at the Oregon Gardens in the same month, and my room charges were almost exactly the same. And my taxes in Chicago were $22, and my taxes at the Oregon Garden was $3 or $3.50. I mean, just a dramatic difference, and it was like, wow, we don't even have a sales tax. And, of course, I was paying sales tax every place I went in Chicago, except maybe the museum, and that wasn't true here either. And it's like, you would think, since every time there's conversation about sales tax, we talk about the fact that we'll be collecting from out-of-state people, then why aren't we collecting where we can? Not just from out-of-state people, but from ourselves when we travel. If I stay in Portland and travel to the beach and don't spend a night, I still won't pay a tax except gas tax. So we do have a broader issue that where we should be looking at sales taxes. But I think that this is a good bill, and you should move forward with it, and you should look at really examining our transient lodging taxes for the whole state. Because there are issues not just for housing, but there are cities on the coasts that have problems with water when, you know, in the high season. And it makes sense for the people who are there visiting during high season to be paying for the changes that are needed. So I hope that you will consider this. I think it's a very important piece of legislation.
Thank you very much. Please.
Thank you so much. Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. My name is Ruth Adkins. I'm with Oregon Opportunity Network. We're the statewide association of affordable housing and community development nonprofits here in support of this bill. So our nonprofit members who work in coastal communities and around the state know that a significant part of the housing crisis is the shortage of workforce housing, whether for folks working on low-wage jobs in the tourism industry, agriculture or fishery workers, teachers, healthcare workers, first responders, and more. We know this issue is particularly acute in coastal communities, where the vacation home and short-term rental market is having a significant negative impact on the availability of housing that is affordable to people who live full-time and work in the community. There simply are not enough homes or apartments, either currently available or under development, to meet the need for housing that is affordable to the local workforce, folks with low incomes. As Commissioner Hall shared with you, nearly 1,000 children in Lincoln County alone who are experiencing homelessness, over 20,000 across the state. It is a crisis. It is simply unacceptable. My understanding is that this bill would not mandate anything. It would simply enable coastal communities to ask their voters to enact this tool, to consider enacting this tool. We see this as a local control issue, and we believe it's crucial that the state enable as many possible tools at the local level that can be used by communities to address their housing needs. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Thank you. We appreciate your testimony. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3260 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2879. And I think there are several members who want to be heard on this bill, aren't there?
Yep.
Okay.
We'll start.
So, tell us what this bill is about.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2879, there is a dash one amendment available in OLIS. And so the measure would exempt from personal and corporate income taxation amounts received from the sale of property to either a nonprofit corporation or a housing authority. And it would apply to tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2018, and before January 1st, 2021. The dash one amendment replaces measure, but it's largely similar. It adds the language that adds a disregarded entity of a nonprofit corporation to the list of qualifying buyers. It also requires that the purchaser participate in an affordable rental housing public investment or subsidy program in order to qualify. It directs the Housing and Community Services Department to establish by rule procedures for certifying the sale of rental housing to certain entities. And it also requires that the housing be offered as affordable rental housing for a period of at least 10 years from the date of purchase. I did happen to just realize that there may be a problem with the relating clause to the measure. It seems to not match up with the content. The relating clause says relating to assessment for real property transactions. I would not interpret that as relating to the income tax related to that. So there may be another vehicle needed if this policy were to move forward.
So, just to be clear, this bill, as written, has to do with income taxes.
Correct.
The word assessments usually refers to the value or tax on real property.
Correct.
Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, let's go ahead and ignore that technical problem for the moment and hear what the idea is.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Representative Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, Julie Parrish, House District 37, representing Westland and Tualatin. And if that is a Scribner's error out of Legislative Council, I would certainly welcome them having a comment about why they drafted the relating to clause that way. And I'm glad to be here with Representative Reardon. So in another legislative session, Representative Reardon and I were assigned to pull together and work with a group of housing proponents, both on the supply side and on the demand side, landlords and tenants coming together to try to identify where there were pressures in the housing system so that we could come up with policies to address them. One of the concerns that came up, and this bill has had support from both landlords and tenants, the side of the equation of the advocates, is that the cost of the underlying land and building these units is not affordable. Certainly in the metro area, for certain, where you have some artificial constraints that drive land use prices, systems development costs that are very expensive. If we're interested in having multifamily unit type housing, and particularly inside urban growth boundaries, then we need to somehow release some of the pressure of the cost side of that equation. And so this bill is about, and this idea came about out of that committee, to basically address having a capital gains offset for the purpose of building this type of land. You know what? I've experienced homelessness before. We grew up in Section 8 housing. To me, housing issues are really critical and important part of your life. You can't do much of anything if you don't have a place to lay your head at night. And so, however, philosophically, where I align is that if we're going to, as a state, say that we're committed to housing and we're committed to affordable housing, you cannot just put that on the backs of one group of individuals and say, this is how we're going to solve the problem. So this is about looking at state resources. And arguably, I don't think this is, we're talking about a huge giveaway for builders here, but we're talking about looking at state resources and saying if collectively we think affordable housing is an issue, then we have to find ways to put more units in the mix. We know we need 80,000 units in the metro area alone. But also that collectively we will pay for that cost and that there is a cost and we recognize that and that one individual or one side of the equation should not be carrying that burden. So we have worked with advocates on both sides of landlord and tenant. You're going to hear from people who are probably a lot more expert than I am at this, but this did come out of a bipartisan work group. It's one of 40 plus ideas that we're going to continue to keep bringing some of these ideas forward to solve some of these issues. But I will pass it to Representative Reardon, who worked hard on.
And let me just interrupt to say we have about 20 minutes, and I have nine people, including the three of you, to testify. You should assume that the committee has heard many, many times about the need for low-income housing. You can skip that part of your testimony. What I understand this bill does is it's a mechanism that would allow the dollars available for low-income housing to go further because it would be an incentive for a seller to give back at least a portion of the tax that would otherwise be paid on capital gains, if I understand the mechanism correctly. If I don't, then please correct me, but please go ahead, Representative Reardon.
Chair Barnhart, committee, Representative Jeff Reardon, District 48. I agree with what you said. Thank you for allowing us to testify today. I'm done.
Oh, thank you.
I
appreciate that because it means I'll get the other six people up.
Yes. Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Smith Warner, members of the committee, thank you so much for having me here today. My name is Allison McIntosh. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Housing Alliance. As Representative Parrish said, this idea came from a work group that they co-convened, the Affordability, Balance, and Choice Work Group. It looked at both new strategies and expanding existing strategies, and that's why House Bill 2879 is before you today. We'd like to expand an existing effective strategy. Just to note, Representative Barnhart, we were also made aware of the concerns about the relating to clause, and we are being in touch with legislative counsel and will be back with an answer on that. So I will skip the parts about the need for affordable housing. I think in the next panel you'll hear a little bit about the fact that this, as a state, we are at a risk of losing a substantial number of affordable units, both regulated affordable housing as well as low-cost private market rental homes, and this bill seeks to address that problem. As regulated affordable housing communities and properties reach the end of their affordability periods, they can convert to market-rate housing, putting tenants at risk of displacement. Our current real estate market has also led to owners selling lower-cost market rental properties. So House Bill 2879 would keep these units affordable by establishing a tax exemption on capital gains on the sale of multifamily affordable housing properties from a private mom-and-pop owner or another private owner to sell to a nonprofit public housing authority. And in 2005, there was a similar exemption created for manufactured home parks that has been very successful. And there's actually a letter in OLIS from the Community and Shelter Assistance Corporation of Oregon that has used this strategy a number of times quite successfully to help resident-owned cooperatives purchase their manufactured home parks and ensure that those remain affordable. I do also want to clarify that it's our intent to have the exemption be on the gain and that we may need an additional amendment. I clearly need to make friends with some tax attorneys to help me read some of these things. So I think the reason that the exemption for manufactured home parks has been so successful is because it's one thing that helps nonprofits or public housing authorities or resident co-ops compete in a overly crowded real estate market. So a lot of times for nonprofits, as you'll hear in the next panel, it takes us a little bit of time to assemble financing and to really get all of the ducks lined up in terms of public resources. And this capital gains exemption can sometimes be a foot in the door to open conversations with owners, and it can be an incentive that just helps us make our case to them as to why they should consider this. So as I said, we believe this will be one more tool to help us preserve existing affordable housing all across the state, and we thank you for your time and consideration today.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Representative Smith-Warren.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you all for being here. I know I've heard this discussed before. Has any nonprofit, has this happened, I mean, with a little bit of the but-for that we always talk about here when you're making tax credit and tax policy, has this happened yet? Like, do we, can you give me an example of some housing that went from, that went into ownership by a nonprofit? Mm-hmm. And
so Chair Barnhart, Representative Smith Warner, this has been used for manufactured home parks. We don't yet have the tool for multifamily housing. We do have two folks who know a lot about the subject who are in the next panel who might be able to better speak to the conversations that they've had with owners about this type of tool. And then we do have one other organization, as I said, Community and Shelter Assistance Corporation, that has used this tool extensively for manufactured home parks. They were not able to be here today, but happy to have them come back and answer questions.
And the follow-up is really what I'm trying to get is, has this happened without the tax credit yet? That's what I'm trying to find, outside of the manufactured home situation.
Representative Smith-Warner, are you talking about are people selling off these properties that are...
Correct.
Yes, that's happening.
And are nonprofits buying them now?
Yes. They're trying to.
Without it, yeah. And the idea is that it's hard, and so this would make it doable. I guess I'm trying to find out, is this happening already without it? Would this make it easier, or would this plan make it pencil out at all?
So, Representative Smith Mortimer, I think it will make it easier because the underlying value of the dirt sometimes is worth more than the structure that's on top of it. So if the goal is to get a nice piece of property where there is essentially affordable housing units there now, and then you wind up with a situation where you do a demo or a big remodel, take it down to the studs or take it down to the foundation and build something back up, those new units are no longer affordable. So this is about the preservation piece of trying to say, if you're going to, you know, sell that property to somebody who wants to develop it into something new, maybe we can give you an incentive to be at a better price point that a nonprofit can afford by offsetting your capital gains to help you get to a price that you can then sell to those to the nonprofit. Because a lot of the funding mechanism, sometimes it's our state dollars, sometimes it's our federal, sometimes it's donation, but and working with private banks as well, trying to line all that up in a timeline when we're in a hot real estate market is pretty difficult. So yes, this is happening, and units are coming off the market, and that's what we heard even 2 years ago in our task force.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. I think the next panel is Brian Shelton Kelly. Looks like Rob Presch, perhaps, and Allison McIntosh. Oh, you're Allison McIntosh. Okay. All right. Let's see. I think we'll go with those two, and then I have another panel of Tim Cowan, Deanna Mack, and Jody Weiser after that. Gentlemen.
Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Smith-Warner, and the committee. My name is Rob Presch. I'm the Preservation Director with the Network for Oregon Affordable Housing. Since 2007, NOAA has managed the Oregon Housing Preservation Project, which has worked in collaboration with public and private partners to preserve nearly 9,000 units of federally subsidized housing. Over the last 5 decades, billions of dollars in public resources have been invested in the development of privately owned, publicly supported housing here in Oregon. As these rent-restricted properties come to the end of their contract period, owners may elect to convert them to market-rate rentals or other uses. So we need to expand our toolbox of public policies to encourage preservation of these properties. There is a growing concern about the loss of Oregon's privately owned rental housing that provides lower rents without government subsidies. In hot real estate markets, these properties are often snapped up quickly by investors, leading to displacement of long-term residents and gentrification of entire neighborhoods. House Bill 2879 would replicate a very effective tool that has been used to help preserve manufactured home parks to protect and expand our supply of affordable housing. House Bill 2879 will provide a state capital gains tax exemption to sellers of existing affordable and market rate housing who decide to sell to a nonprofit organization or public housing agency. This is a proven approach that has helped preserve manufactured home parks across the state by providing nonprofits and resident cooperatives the means to compete with private investors. We're confident this incentive will work equally well with the multifamily sector. I should note that the bill has a 3-year sunset and requires annual reports to be submitted by Oregon Housing to the Department of Revenue, which will allow the tax exemption to be monitored and its impact measured. Before I close, let me just briefly mention what the Dash 1 amendment does. First, it recognizes a limited liability corporation or limited partnership formed by a nonprofit organization or housing authority as an eligible purchasing entity. And you'll see this referred to in the bill as a disregarded entity. This is commonly used in the affordable housing industry to help create ownership structures that allow for investment of private capital. Next, when a seller receives a capital gains tax exemption, the amendment requires that the housing purchased by the nonprofit or housing authority be affordable for at least 10 years, be affordable for much longer if there are other public resources used as well. And lastly, the amendment gives HCS the authority to certify sales under the exemption and requires annual reporting to the Department of Revenue. So, thank you for the opportunity to address the committee today, and I ask for your support of the bill.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Thank you. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Brian Shelton Kelly. I'm the Director of Acquisitions and Real Estate Development with NeighborWorks Umpqua. NeighborWorks Umpqua is a nonprofit community development corporation. We're based in Roseburg in beautiful Douglas County. We provide housing that's affordable, asset building, lending and home ownership services, and economic development in Southern Oregon, primarily in Douglas, Coos, and Curry counties. We're here today to urge the passage and support of HB 2879. We feel it's a valuable additional tool that organizations such as ourselves can use to more ably compete in the acquisition of properties. Even in rural communities such as Roseburg, there's competition for multifamily properties, and most nonprofits don't have cash on hand to do outright purchases. We often have to cobble together financing and funding from a variety of sources, public, private, other, and that takes time. And many sellers are interested in a quick transaction, a quick sale. I think the value we see in this tool is it would provide an additional opportunity to open the door for dialogues on those transactions, on those sales, and give us an ability to work with owners that this tax exemption would provide them an incentive that might offset some of the patience or the longer time frames that they might need to work with on a acquisition of this type. I think this is a valuable tool in looking at preserving the housing in our communities that already exists. We see that as a very cost-effective method to addressing the housing crisis that the state is facing, and any additional tools that can help facilitate that are most welcome. So thank you for the opportunity, and we urge the passage of this bill.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? I have a couple, and I think it's for other people who are in the room listening too. It would be, you've made the assertion that this mechanism has been useful in the transfer of mobile home parks. I think it would be useful to get some data that demonstrates that. I see Mr. Van Landingham is here and others who have been working on that, so you might be able to put something together or simply provide us with the report that you already have. I think it would be helpful to understand the other taxing mechanisms that are involved here. I think some of these properties are subject to real property taxes, and others of them may not be, depending upon how they're specifically set up. And so that would be the kind of useful information. And finally, how this mechanism leverages your ability to close a purchase. I can easily imagine a situation in which you've got a private party that's held an asset like this for 30 years, where most of the value of the asset is reflected in capital gains rather than their basis. And this could be a pretty valuable consideration for them, mm-hmm. if it were available. I think it would be useful to have some idea of the kinds of properties you're looking at and what your estimate is of how useful this mechanism would be in numbers. It would be useful to have it in numbers in addition to your assertions. I don't have a question that I think you can answer today, but that would be really helpful, I think, as we look forward at this bill. Finally, obviously, we have to find a bill with the right relating clause if we're going to go ahead with something like this. Anything else? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
The last panel is Tim Cowan, Deanna Mack, and Jody Weiser, please. Thank you. We've received Mr. Collins' written statements, and he chooses not to testify. Thank you very much. Yes, ma'am.
For the record, Jody Weiser for Tax Fairness, Oregon. The question you just raised, Chair Barnhart, is explored in some examples on the backside of my testimony. I'm afraid that the capital gains benefit could be far larger than the public benefit in some of the in some possible situations, and I don't see anything in the bill that actually marries the two together in any way, because if a property has a huge amount of capital gains, then that it could be very expensive. And so I think that basically we should look at using our general fund money after we've received it to subsidize low-income housing rather than looking for methodologies that we really have a hard time writing any controls around. And so that would be my testimony about this bill. Thanks.
Is your testimony in OLIS?
It should be.
Has it been posted? Please go ahead, and we'll figure that out in a minute.
Members of the committee, for the record, Deanna Mack, Department of Revenue. And I was coming up to testify about some of the technical issues that we noticed with the bill. Mainly, first, I appreciate the amendment to require the subtraction to be certified by an agency. Since it's not applicable to everyone, it would make it's nice that that is in there. We would ask for that. The bill does not address what a qualifying sale is, in particular if there's bargain sales. Bargain sales are a special kind of beast, because part of the fair market value of that sale is a charitable contribution. So if it's intended to be a fair market value sale, then we probably should say that if bargain sales are allowed, then we need to deal with the charitable contribution and perhaps have an add back in the event that there is a charitable contribution deduction as well. So this is the tax geek that Allison was talking about. The other component is the amounts received. Generally, you're going to want to say something along the lines of any amount of gain included in federal taxable income to limit that, rather than the amounts received would be the sale of the purchase price. In most cases.
Right. I think they acknowledged that was a drafting error. Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's actually the same in the mobile home park language, but the way we've administered it is limiting it to the gain that's in there. So if you wanted to to change that as well. That would be we wouldn't be upset about that. As far as the impact of the mobile home capital gain, the mobile home park capital gain, we would be appreciative of that same evaluation of that program. As you know, we publish the tax expenditure report every year, or every biennium for you folks. And in that particular one, that is not one that has been evaluated. So if you do get that feedback, we'd be happy to take it in our research section and incorporate it in this publication for you. So with that, if you have any questions.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. And with that, colleagues, we have no more witnesses on this bill. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2879. Paul, is there anything I should announce? See you all tomorrow. With that, the committee's adjourned.